Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll speak with our correspondent traveling in Europe following the immigrant crisis there. Get details of the recent fighting in Yemen. We have good news and bad news about human longevity. And we'll hear about an Australian rugby star who is giving it all up for American football.
He's got a lot to learn in terms of the game. He probably doesn't run off the blockers as well as most people, but I think that's what's confusing the opposition. They're not too sure what he's going to do next.
It's here on The Voice of America. The stream of refugees into Europe continues today, and VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is following this story. He's traveling around the region to meet with the refugees and see what they're doing. Right now, he's in Budapest, Hungary, and joins us on the line. Luis, what is going on today?
Well, as you said, the stream continues, Susan. And what is happening is that with Hungary lifting many of the restrictions that it had imposed on the refugees, word is getting back to those who are at the earlier stages of this pipeline. What I am hearing from the border now is I just got off the phone with a Hungarian relief worker who is helping deal with the influx. He described a very dire situation as people are hearing of the assured passage through Hungary. They're deciding to make the trip. Some have been holding in Macedonia. Some have been in Serbia. They're making their way toward Hungary. The Hungarian government has said it is reinforcing its border controls. There is a fence with razor-sharp wire that exists there. The government said that it will repair the holes in which many of these refugees have been using to cross. Others have been using railroad track, rail lines, to come from Serbia into Hungary. And so that is a situation that the Hungarian government is very much bracing for. On the other end, you have Austria, which has been receiving the migrants very efficiently, taking them from the trains that they're arriving from in Vienna, and putting them onto trains bound for Germany, where many of the migrants tell me is, in fact, where they want to go.
And how can they handle all these people? What supplies are there for them?
There's been an incredible outpouring of goodwill donations on the part of private citizens. The government has also been facilitating matters in that they've installed water faucets. There are washing facilities. There are signs pointing them to where they need to go to catch the train to the border. But mainly it's private relief organizations, private individuals showing up with bags of food, offering assistance. There are even people driving into Budapest, both from within Hungary and also people from the Czech Republic who I talked to, who are driving their private cars and offering transportation to the border. Now, this is a situation that the Hungarian government has warned people against. They are warning people that the law does not allow private citizens to transport people who are undocumented across Hungarian territory. Nonetheless, the people I spoke to, the volunteers, said that when they hear the news reports of the suffering of these refugees, they cannot help but come and do whatever they can personally to ease what they see as purely a matter of human suffering.
Luis, please describe to us the enormity of this problem, the number of peoples, the crowds.
The Hungarian government estimates that 10,000 people have come in within the last few days. They anticipate many thousands more coming through. Concerns expressed by observers across Europe, really. These are opinions you hear from in the UK as well, all the way east to Hungary, is a concern about the effect that this influx may have on the demographics of Europe. The entire continent basically has a very low birth rate when it comes to native-born Europeans. the number of foreign-born people is increasing, consistently. And so there are concerns about demographic change. When I've asked the volunteers if they have, this concern in mind, they say, sure, but it's not something that's immediate. If it happens, it will be in the next generation. And for now, what we have in front of us is a situation where human beings are suffering and where they are fleeing for their lives.
And Luis, when I spoke with you yesterday, you mentioned that many of these people would really rather be at home than be in this situation going to another country.
I've interviewed dozens of refugees in the days that I've been here, Susan, and I can tell you that not one has said that he or she is happy making this trip. Every single one has said, if things were okay in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, I would be home. That's what I'm getting consistently from people. There's also some expressions of frustration and anger on why the United States is not doing more to end the fighting in Syria. They said that if the fighting in Syria, as one example, were to end, there would be absolutely no reason to leave their country.
Well, thank you very much, Luis, for speaking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchewski with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, this migrant story continues to trend as they make their way across Europe, as we heard Luis talk about as he's over there. And the term that's trending right now is 20,000 Syrians. And this is because the UK has said they will take in 20,000 Syrians by 2020. So that announcement's making a lot of waves on social media. A lot of people saying it's great that the UK is taking this step. Other people saying it's not enough. So it's a back and forth on social media about that, and people waiting to see what other countries will jump in. I know there have been announcements by Germany and other countries welcoming these migrants in.
And Australia also has said they want to help out.
Exactly. Australia has said they want to help out. We talked about on the earlier show about the candlelight vigils in Australia,
right.
So a lot of sympathy for the migrants there, and seeing if perhaps the U.S. will take them in or other countries, maybe in the West, but
mm-hmm.
Who knows? We'll see. The other big story trending today is Superhenge. Stonehenge, of course, the big stone monument in the UK. Well, they found one, they're unearthing one that they said is massive in scale. Nearly 100 stones, and it's only about 3 kilometers from Stonehenge, so it's right nearby, but they're saying that there might be more things buried underground. So that's being talked about a lot, saying what else are they going to find as they dig down near around Stonehenge, and what else will they find?
So, great mysteries.
Great mysteries and a lot of speculation for sure.
Okay, thank you so much, Andrew. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Gum diseases such as gingivitis or periodontitis can pose serious health risks for people. But now, scientists have found that an extract from wild blueberries can help prevent the formation of dental plaque that can lead to these ailments. The scientists say their discovery could lead to new therapies to fight gum disease. The early stage gum disease, gingivitis, occurs when oral bacteria forms a biofilm or plaque on teeth. This dental plaque can then harden into tartar, which then must be painfully scraped away by dentists. If gingivitis continues, the inflammation it causes can progress to a more serious infection called periodontitis, which can lead to tooth loss. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Saudi-led airstrikes pounded the Yemeni capital Sana'a Sunday following Friday's missile attack by Shiite Houthi rebels that killed 60 Saudi, Emirati, and Bahraini troops. VOA's Victor Beatty is on top of this story. Victor, what's happening?
Susan, Sunday's strikes targeted troops loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, an ally of the Houthis, while witnesses and security officials insist civilian targets were also hit. Analysts quoted by the French press agency insist that Friday's missile strike will only strengthen the resolve of the Saudi-led coalition to neutralize the threat to Yemen posed by the Iran-backed rebels. The Saudi-led air campaign began in late March in support of exiled President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. Speaking with me earlier, Human Rights Watch researcher Ahmed Benchemsi agreed that Sunday's airstrikes sought to avenge Friday's deadly missile attack on Saudi-led coalition forces in Marib.
Latest information show that the airstrikes and bombings of the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, which is currently held by Houthi rebels, has intensified drastically during this weekend. So this shows that the Saudis and the Emiratis and the members of the Saudi-led coalition are determined to fight back, and this will only escalate a war that has been extremely deadly already so far.
Ahmed, the rebels have suffered some losses since July. Are they on the losing end at this point?
Well, it depends on what region of the country we're talking about. For example, the Houthi rebels were seizing the city of Aden until last July. Then they retreated after southern coalitions that are supported by the Saudi-led coalition regained control of the city. So, and while the infighting still continues in Sana'a, the capital, which is still held by the Houthis, so it depends on which part of the country we're talking about.
Are you hopeful at all that this conflict will come to an end anytime soon?
There are some efforts pushed by the UN trying to push negotiations in Muscat and Oman, but they are so far not going anywhere because the fighting continues unabated and it's even increasing. So the peace efforts so far, unfortunately, it seems pretty much inaudible by both parties.
Ahmed, Iran indicates that it's not really directly involved. Do you believe that, or are they actively supporting the Houthis?
Well, the support of the Houthis by Iran is an open secret. It's been evoked by all the media and public opinion in the region. So it's a lot of media reports and a lot of analysis understand the situation as a proxy war between forces backed by the Sunni powerhouses in the region, which are Saudi and other Gulf countries, and the Houthi rebels who are backed by Iran. This is the common analysis of what's going on in Yemen.
Human Rights Watch has blamed the Houthi forces for laying banned anti-personnel landmines around Aden. Is it just the Houthis are doing this, or do you implicate the Saudi-backed government forces?
Not for landmines. Landmines, apparently, it's the Houthi doing, because before they retreated from Aden, apparently they have planted lots of landmines in the city, which is a clear violation of the rules of war, because the explosive remnants are indiscriminate weapons who can target fighters as much as civilians. But on the other side, the use of indiscriminate weapons as well, we also documented the use of cluster munitions by the Saudi-led coalition, and the cluster munitions are as harmful as anti-personnel mines, and also, and as importantly, as indiscriminate, because, as you know, cluster munitions, it consists in dropping submunitions which can fall anywhere and which can be found by civilians and children and explode long after the strike. So they harm civilians as well.
And Human Rights Watch says at least 11 people were killed, a dozen more wounded by exploding landmines and explosive remnants in Aden in August.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, is a longer life worth living? And an athlete makes major changes to fulfill a lifelong dream. There's both good news and bad news about life expectancy. The good news is people are living longer. The bad news is there's a bigger risk of poor health. My colleague Joe DiCapo has been looking at a new report on the issue and joins me here in the studio. And it's the first time I think Joe has been in here. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joe, what did you find out?
Well, Susan, around the world, life expectancy has risen by 6 years since 1990. Pretty good news. But the study says much of that is due to advances against HIV/AIDS and also malaria. Also, progress has been made in reducing deaths from communicable diseases and also maternal, newborn, and nutritional disorders. Theo Voss is the lead author of that study. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. And he tells me there's been a marked reduction in mortality rates from just about all causes.
Most importantly, all the infectious diseases that affect young children, the neonatal problems, so the problems following birth. But we've also seen very steady declines in injury deaths, and the rates of mortality from some of the big non-communicable diseases are slowly, or a bit more than slowly, declining as well.
For many, however, the quality of life in those extra years may be marred by health problems. Once again, Professor Voss.
You increase the average lifespan of people, and with increasing age, you are more likely to get diseases that impair your ability to function. While we've been relatively successful at reducing the big causes of death, we've been less successful in making a dent in these causes of long-term disabilities.
Voss says some diseases and disabilities can be prevented, but he says investment in both treating or curing them has not kept pace with investments for major diseases.
So we make a plea to medical research community to start thinking about investing more in those big causes of disability rather than mortality. And hopefully that will lead to some of the breakthroughs that we've seen that have led to the reduction in mortality.
Say, Joe, what did the scientists base the report on?
Well, the findings are based on an analysis of all major diseases and injuries in 188 countries. And Professor Voss says the goal is to find opportunities to improve health.
Well, thanks, Joe, for sharing with us, and don't be such a stranger.
Right. Live long and prosper.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Australian rugby star Jared Hayne has been selected for the final 53-man roster of the San Francisco 49ers of American-style professional football, a remarkable achievement and lifetime dream of the 27-year-old, who may begin his rookie year as a member of the special teams, returning kickoffs or running back. Australian Broadcasting Corporation radio sportscaster Shannon Byrne says Hayne turned his back on a wildly successful rugby career to play in the NFL.
On Saturday, it was actually 1 year ago that he played his final game of rugby league here in Australia. So, you know, you're talking about a year where he was one of the top paid players in the sport of rugby league in Australia. He was earning $1 million a year, and in our sport over here, that is one of the marquee mans of the game. And he had his last game, and then a month later, he told the world that he was thinking of heading over to the States to try out, really just to get, I guess, an understanding and see what he could do in the world of the NFL. And look, the remarkable story is, you know, what, not even a month, 6 weeks ago, he put on the pads and the helmet for the first time for his preseason games and has absolutely stunned the world over there. We knew what he was capable of, but the more the story comes out is that this has been a journey that really started a couple of years ago. Everybody found out that he was such a fan of American football that he'd been watching it and studying it and, as he even said, playing it on computer games for most of his life. But he actually joined a university side back here in Australia in about 2012 and really started to go to training just to find out a little bit about different positions. Then he would play a whole season of his NRL. Then a year after that, he would go back to the university and start doing a couple of practice games again with the local gridiron team. And, yeah, just an absolute remarkable story for a man that really only thought a year ago, when you think of how many people in the system that you guys have in the States through high school and also in college football, He was no chance. When he left just over a year ago, most people thought that this was going to be a huge dream and that probably not getting on the 53-man roster in his first attempt. And, it is just a remarkable story. In the newspapers, 6 pages deep at the front of the newspaper. That's not even the sports section. So, everybody has gone wild in Australia, and I think it's just catching on now in the States.
We asked Shannon to walk us through the transition from rugby to American-style football.
We call it rugby league here, and it's a sport where he was fullback. So he ran a lot more on his toes. It's a game where it's a contact game for 80 minutes, and you have 13 on the field, and you don't have any protection gear. You don't wear helmets. You don't wear pads, and you've got to get through basically a wall of 13 men and get the ball over the goal line or the try line to get 4 points. For what we've seen with the transition of Jarryd Hayne is a lot of it was he had to learn even to run differently because with his position, he could get the ball and he was trying to run like a sprinter up on his toes. His body was very upright. And when he went over to the States, the first thing they wanted to do was bring down his centre of gravity, obviously, because the hits were going to be more frequent. And if you're running on your toes, if you could just imagine pushing someone on their toes, they wouldn't be quite as stable as to someone that's running more on their heels and have a centre of gravity when you're looking at some of the big boys that he'll come up against in the NFL. So they had to completely change his running style. He had to put on weight and become a lot stronger than his frame when he was over here playing an 80 minutes of games he would play and run around for that full 80 minutes. Now he's going to be playing shorter, more impact in his positions. And, so he doesn't have to be quite as aerobically fit, more just work on his anaerobic, but he has bulked up considerably. They've changed his running style. And, he's got a lot to learn in terms of the game. He probably doesn't run off the blockers as well as most people, but I think that's what's confusing the opposition. They're not too sure what he's going to do next.
Byrne says despite the time difference, Australians hope Hayne plays in San Francisco's season opener against the Minnesota Vikings on September 14th. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, America pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's strength and prosperity. The notion that work is valued, and even noble, dates to the ancients. "Seest thou a man diligent in his labor?" the book of Proverbs asks. "He shall stand before kings." In the United States, the belief goes back well over a century. As a holiday, the Labor Day celebration began in the 1880s in New York City, with an effort by labor unions to demonstrate the numbers, strength, and spirit of working men and women. They organized parades and rallies and used the demonstrations to press for new laws to benefit workers, such as standardizing the 8-hour workday. The movement spread to other cities, and in 1894, Congress made it a national holiday honoring all American workers. The association with trade and labor unions has declined over the years. Today, for most people, the holiday represents the last long weekend of summer, a time to relax and spend time with family and friends. There are still parades and rallies, particularly in election years, and also sporting events and picnics. For many, Labor Day means a no Labor Day before the change of seasons and start of a new school year. Over time, work in the U.S. itself has changed. More Americans now are occupied in offices and services than who toil on the factory floor. The connection between the holiday and the nation's workers remains real, though, as recognition of the source of so much of America's economic and social achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.